the network for the AV industry.
What are you listening to?
This
is AV.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Week, episode 185, recorded Friday, March 6th, 2015. Net Mob Mentality.
Ready.
AV Week.
Performing scan.
AV Week.
Online.
This is AV Week.
This is AV Week, your weekly wrap-up of audiovisual news and information. My name is Tom Albright. I am your host. With us this week is Josh Shruggo from ICS and SoundReason.org. How are you, sir?
Doing well. Ready to see the weekend after Tampa and Infocom Connections. It's been a crazy couple of days.
Yeah, we're going to have to talk about Infocom Connections and the fact that you survived a panel with Mr. Danto. So
I did, and not just him, but many industry veterans like Paul Depperschmidt as well.
I didn't realize Paul was on there. Very cool. Awesome.
Yes, I was. He and I had lovely conversations on the panel.
Mm-hmm. Also with us is Dawn Mead from NetAV. How are you, madam?
Very good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about something exciting that Dawn did as well, technically last week, but we posted it this week, so it's kind of cool. And last but not least, be nice to him because he's brand new. His name is Bill, and Bill is from AV Awakenings. He is a partner there. How are you, sir?
Happy Friday to you.
Yay! Bill and Shraga are both from the West Coast. Dawn's in the East Coast, and I'm the big dumb American right there in the middle. First up, before we get started, AV Nation is kind of a family, and something cool happened to one of our family members this week. Our buddy Matt D. Scott from London, Ontario, and Omega Audio Video, he and his lovely bride welcomed their first child, Cohen D. Scott, to the AV community. So we have a new... an up-and-coming AV geek on the way. So,
well, let's not forget Lo-Fi.
Well, Lo-Fi is still not happened yet. So explain what Mr. Shrago is talking about. Our buddy Phil Cordell, Hi-Fi is what he's called, is the only AV rapper that I'm aware of. His partner, his lovely bride, is also expecting, but they have not had said baby yet.
There was a video that went out this morning that showed they were on their way, though. She was in hospital gown.
She was in hospital gown, but it has still not taken place yet. So, and actually, stupid. This is I'm rabbit trailing here. So there was three gentlemen that was involved in our AV selfie video last year in Vegas. Hi-Fi, Phil Cordell, Matt Scott, and our buddy Josh Pippins, who was our videographer. He's a good, longtime friend of mine, but good kid. I'm just going to say that all three of them, their wives ended up pregnant. Not sure what that has to say with about the water or whatever in Vegas or what have you. So
what that tells you is if you want to have a kid, be in an AV Nation video and...
Yes. There you
go. Magic happens.
Something, yeah. So, all right. So, yeah, congratulations to Mr. and Mrs. Scott there. A couple of Amazon stories to get us started this week. First up, this is from CNET. The Amazon App Store is nearing 400,000 apps on quote-unquote huge progress. This is from CNET. The e-commerce giant has been behind Apple and Google in the App Store race, though it's taken steps to improve its offering, and those are starting to pay off. Mr. Shruggo, one of the things that has kind of developed over the last few years, my full-time job, I run a programming house out of St. Louis, is the mobile form of control and automation, at least when it comes to Crestron, AMX, Extron, everybody else and their brother has a mobile device, has a mobile app. I am not aware of an Amazon Fire specific app, though they may exist. Is it time with this number of downloads and this number of apps on the Amazon App Store for Crestron and AMX and the other big players to start looking at that as a viable mobile option?
Is it time?
Yeah.
Well, it's never not the time to explore an open opportunity where you could put something that people are utilizing on a daily basis. I mean, that's just good business. Whether or not they're actually going to invest those efforts is an entirely different thing. The fact is, you know, you look at 400,000 apps, and that's great. Look at the Windows. Look at the Windows Store. I mean, I'm sitting here on my Surface Pro 3, and you know what, the apps that are available for it are still pretty limited when it comes to the stuff that I use on a daily basis. But the benefit of it is that I don't have to use an app. So that's kind of that upside. It's a business avenue that's always worth exploring. Whether or not they're going to see any real returns, I mean, I'd be really curious to see what kind of real returns they're seeing on their apps right now between Extron, AMX, and Crestron as to what they're actually getting. Whether or not it is profitable for them at this point, because as many people like to point out, they are touch panel sellers that are losing their market to better touch panels from places like Apple and places like Microsoft, who are making much, much better panels, and now we're putting an app on them. So, yeah, it's worth it for the investment, but I don't think it's going to get the return that they would get from a piece of hardware.
Okay. Bill, from your standpoint and your point of view, Josh makes a good point bringing up the Microsoft Surface, which he is personally a big fan of. I'm still actually in discussions with one of my programmers who wants to move to that platform to program on. I know there are some people who do, and I'm not, you know, again, this is a discussion. but does it make sense to go down these other, I'm going to call them ancillary roads, because they're not as popular as the Android platform or the iOS platform, whether that's a Windows mobile phone, the Surface, the Amazon Fire tablet. Does it make sense to go down those roads?
It might, if we're speaking specifically on the Amazon Fire tablet, because that's the article that we were referring to here. The thing we have to remember about the Amazon Fire tablet is it's an Android device with a skin on it. So the development, it would not necessarily be an overhaul. What they really need to do is they just need to modify the Android application that they're writing for that device. But also remember that we need to not necessarily think of the Amazon Fire tablet as a tablet other than for content consumption. It really isn't an iPad. It really isn't it certainly isn't a Surface Pro. It's a really, really awesome Kindle that has skinned Android apps on it that have been semi-modified for the Fire UI. Now, that said, what I think would be valuable would be for these companies, Crestron, Control4, Savant, AMX, etc., to consider writing stuff for the Surface. I think that product is definitely going to gain some serious traction. It's got a really good following. I think it's only going to grow. And certainly there's no limitation to in terms of the hardware capabilities of a Surface to run any level of app that they want to develop for it. So yes, I think it's time that the companies start to seriously give consideration beyond iOS and typical Android. I'm just not sure that, because you got to also remember these companies have to play their software development based on the numbers. What are they going to get in return for it? And if the investment in programming is going to be equal to writing for iOS or writing for Android, they need to be able to get a return on that investment. I don't see it going to Amazon Fire, but I could see it landing on Surface Pro pretty quickly as an app, perhaps.
All right. Dawn, to Bill's point, is it the Surface as the next step?
You know, the Surface is great, and I think the newer Surfaces, they're getting rid of the kind of exclusive, non-compatible Surface. I don't remember the exact flavor, RT or something like that. Windows RT it ran, and the new one runs regular Windows. Something like that, yeah. I mean, Harry, Mr. AV Dawn, is looking at getting a Surface. You know, he thinks it's a fantastic option. I think that they should have options available from the manufacturers for those. But regarding the Raider question, is it going to be Amazon? I don't think so. And, I mean, I'm an Amazon fan. I actually own a first-generation Kindle Fire before they put in Bluetooth and made it useful, back when it was basically just a glorified reader with a couple of apps. I love it for its purpose. I also own an Android tablet separate from that, that's actually used for productivity things. So, you know, God bless Amazon. They're awesome. They're great at what they do. But, you know, stick with what you do. Don't try to be everything to everyone. I personally think what the manufacturers need to do is make a bigger effort. All manufacturers make a bigger effort at building just Android apps, even before we get to the Surface. Because as it is, if you look at the app stores, way more apps are available and way more useful apps are available on my iFormat, despite the fact that as of what, third or fourth quarter of 2014, 70 to 75% of the world's devices shipped were Android devices.
Yep.
But people are still building for an iWorld. I mean, yeah, I's sexy and I people love them, but Android is really where they need to develop. And if we can get that taken care of, that's already got saturation, then look at things like the Surface, I think would be a lot better said for everybody.
And she, you know, and Don, sorry to jump in here, Don makes an interesting point that yes, you know, as of the last report, there is a gigantic percentage majority for Android shipped devices. However, the reason that that things are still developed for the iOS store first is because iOS device owning people buy apps at an astronomically greater rate and spend a greater amount of money than Android people do. And again, if you're going to build an app and it's going to cost money, you're going to make your money on the iOS app store over the Android over the Google Play store by a pretty great margin still. I think that will probably begin to shift. But that's why you see stuff developed on iOS first and primarily is because that's where the money is.
Well, and there's another point there with the Android apps, which causes some of the problems in that just because you put an app on the Android store, it doesn't mean it'll actually work across all platforms of Android. And app developers on Android are slower. Android app developers have been much, much slower to move across with mm-hmm. every single software update to Android.
Right. And again, the hardware fragmentation that comes with the Android world, because there's so many different manufacturers making pieces of hardware that run different Android flavors.
Though to be fair, and to your point, Bill, is it the people are buying more apps because they're willing to spend more money, or is it there are more apps available? I know countless times I've been like, take my money here. Here's sure. my credit card. Give me the app. And it's just not available. So I'm not going to buy that app.
Right. And I think there's a good portion that of credence lent to the fact that the iOS app store has been out longer. So there's been a greater amount of development availability. The SDKs have been there longer. So there's an advantage to the iOS app store there. And interestingly enough, and taking this outside of those of us that are, you know, definitely technology savvy people, the clientele that we have, overwhelming majority are iOS people, and when we have the Android user, we have the Crestron apps and we have the security camera apps that are available on the Google Play Store. I have yet to come across a single client that we've done work for that I needed to load an Android app onto their phone where they didn't have to set up the Google Play Store for the first time because they'd never used it, which baffles me. I'm like, are you serious? He's like, I've never done this. I need a credit card, and I'm like, what?
Oh my God.
I have never run into that with an iOS owner, not one time. And yet every single Android owner is like, I have to put a credit card in to put an app on my phone. I'm like, are you for real?
Well, is that part of the fact that you almost are forced to when you start a new iOS device, right? And I'm not going to get into, you know, the fascists, you know, versus, you know, free market type thing on Apple versus Google. But almost immediately, it takes you to the Apple store, the iOS store, and says, here, give me your credit card so you can run your device.
It doesn't. That's actually not true. It does encourage you to attach all that stuff together. But frankly, every Android phone built for the last, like, 6 years, one of the first things it does when you're powering it up is it says, enter your Gmail account, or if you don't have one, create one here. And people will actually go, no, I'll do that later, and then never get around to it and wonder why their phone doesn't get software updates.
Yeah.
So wow. It's the whole thing. Yeah, Don, I can see the look on your face. It's fascinating, the disparity between the two. I don't know what to attest it to, you know?
Yeah, this shocks me because I've never had that problem, but I guess I just hang out with geekier people.
There is that.
Like everyone I know has that. Foreign.
Yeah, there is definitely that. All right, the other Amazon story. At this point, I don't know who said Amazon's trying to be everything to everyone. So I'm becoming really, really horrible at this. So I'm going to try an attempt to share screw it. It's not even working now. All right, screw it. So Amazon, a buddy of mine sent me this. it is called Amazon Services. I'll put a link on the show notes. When you go to it, wherever your zip code is, it will show you what you can get. Currently up, I have the TV wall mounting near 62002, which is where our studios are located. It's a little town called Alton, Illinois, in southwest Illinois. I can purchase a 50-inch display being mounted by someone here locally. I have a couple of different options. Do I own my own mounting bracket? Yes or no? Should the wires be concealed inside a cord or inside the wall? This, that, and the other. And I click on add to cart. $200 to get this thing mounted. So, Bill, as someone who does this for, granted, this is for residential, right? This is not, I don't expect the CEO of Mallinckrodt, it's a local, you know, bigger company, or Monsanto here in St. Louis to do this. But is this something, are you concerned about this, or is this something where it would make sense for you to even jump on board and sign AV Awakenings up to the Amazon service?
It doesn't fit our business model, so we would not join up for this service, nor does it really compete with us specifically. My concern is, and I know that, and I kind of looked into this a little bit, they are contracting, at least when I put my zip code in, 97034, which is Lake Oswego, Oregon, which is a suburb of Portland. it comes up with the service pros are using Dish Smart Home Services, as in Dish Network, the satellite TV provider.
Okay.
And it says, background check, licensed and certified, top rated performers. Well, are you? I mean, you say you are, and that's fine, but every individual state has different licensing requirements for low voltage installations and high voltage installations, different licenses, different testing, different supervision. And this, to me, falls in the in kind of the Best Buy Geek Squad gray area. For example, in the state of Oregon, without a low voltage license, you are allowed to do cable TV, telephone, and audio, and you can pull audio like speaker wire. However, you may not do networking, you may not do security, and you clearly can't do anything with high voltage. Also, you can't pull high voltage, like you can't take the power cord that comes with the TV. You may not stuff that inside the drywall, push it down, and pull it out the other side. That violates UL, that is a fire code violation, and if you are a licensed person, you get your license pulled for that. In the state of Washington, as an unlicensed person, you may not touch a wire, period. Not one. You may not pull a wall plate off as a professional. So say you send your Geek Squad guys out to do a TV hang, and neither of them hold a license. They're actually not allowed to even connect your cable box to the cable jack that's on the wall, because you are connecting wire that's within the wall.
Holy cow.
And that's Washington's rule. So my concern with this is they say they're licensed, but are they really licensed for that state that they're going to do the work in? And the actual person that comes to your house, is he actually what we would call an LEA, a limited energy, a licensed person? Because if they're not, and a problem happens, there is the onus is on the client to pay for any sort of repairs or damage that happens from it.
Wow. Now,
so it makes me nervous.
Just curiosity here, because of your location to the state of Washington, do you do much work in there?
We do when it makes cost-effective sense. Not to say that, you know, somebody's money isn't worth more than another person's money, but you know, we're about a 20-minute drive from the Washington border, so we're very, very close to Vancouver, and we have a number of clients that are in Vancouver that we do work with, but we do have business licenses in Oregon and Washington. We do have limited energy licenses and bonding and insurance in Oregon and Washington, and then our lead technician has a limited energy A license in both Oregon and Washington, so that we are legally allowed to go do that. But what's interesting is the dance that we have to do. Say we go do a rather ornate system in the state of Washington. I am technically not allowed to connect, say, the speaker wire that was pre-wired into the rack. I can build the rack in Oregon. We can ship it there. But Mark, our lead engineer, is the one who actually has to physically make the connectivity from the cables in the wall into the rack.
Okay, time out here.
Yeah, no. It gets crazy complex.
No,
which is why this makes me nervous.
Yeah, okay, so I've said this before. I live in the suburb of St. Louis. Technically, my house is in southwest Illinois. But just like Bill here, we kind of, you know, straddle both states. Nothing like that. So you're doing to tell me that you're the actual license holder has to be the person physically connecting the cables.
If we want to follow the letter of Washington State's law, directly to the letter, yes.
Okay. Now, you can claim anonymity. You can claim the Fifth Amendment if you want. Does that always happen?
We do our best to make sure that the rule is being followed, at least to the spirit.
The spirit. I love that. All right. Interesting.
I was going to say, Tim.
Yes.
Don't flinch too much, because here in Maryland, at least out there, it's on a state-by-state basis.
Yeah.
Here in Maryland, in my county, there are no licensing requirements whatsoever. In Baltimore County, 9 miles away, you have to have a restricted license for low voltage, either for low voltage restricted speakers or low voltage restricted security. And then each individual county within the state of Maryland has its own requirements, not counting doing work in the District of Columbia, doing work in Virginia, doing work in West Virginia, all of which are right here.
Yeah.
So I feel Bill's pain times some.
Good night. All right. Well, then Don, to Bill's point on this, is this something that would make even in any sense in you guys' area, or is it just kind of?
This is something that is one of the main reasons my company is shifting its business model. It is every security company, every cabling company, you know, structured cabling firm, anybody that touches wire cable or anything of the sort has been encroaching on AV install. And when I started in the industry 15 years ago, we'd make our bread and butter hanging projectors and screens. Now you can go to Amazon, you can go to Geek Squad, you can go to Kmart practically and say, yes, I'd like this installed and take care of it for me. And it's $100 and they send out someone licensed and bonded or not, and they take care of it for you. So this is why all of the BLC and the Infocom events, everybody's been talking about you better change your business model, you better rethink how you're doing AV. This is why. This is a case in point why, if you're an integrator watching or listening to this right now and you're still trying to make your money on markups on equipment and on installation, you need to rethink your business model or you need to get your resume ready to go work for someone else.
Well, all right, Shrago, we've talked about you know, licenses and bonds and stuff like that. You live in the world of, you know, from my point of view, you know, the state of regulation, California. So what's it like in your area?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you over that trunk slamming.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
Nice.
Oh, good night.
I saw this and I just laughed. I laughed hard, very, very, very hard. And I mean, you talk about regulation. There are actually two licenses that you, in California alone, for low voltage and high voltage. So you have the C7 or you have the C10, and what you're capable of touching on is predictive of that. And then whether or not you're a C10 dictates whether or not you can run conduit, or which, if you're not a high voltage, how many feet of conduit can you run? And it just gets into this like, we're a low voltage contractor, but we can technically bring our own conduit, but we can only do 10 feet a day, literally 10 feet a day. So it gets into those kinds of fun things. So you do get into the regulations of it all. And I just, you know, this is one of those things where it's, they're trying to cut corners. And I appreciate the fact that Amazon is doing something to offer a service to compete against an actual physical location store. I appreciate what they're attempting to do. But unless there's actually going to be some sort of standard applied to this and there's going to be some sort of review process that goes above and beyond a 5-star, how are they determining who gets to be on this other than, hey, sign up to be a service provider, which is exactly what they've offered. There's nothing in here that states that these people are qualified under any circumstances, and it literally will be somebody slamming their trunk, possibly on your mount or TV, as they arrive at your location.
Yep.
You know what? Indeed. We've talked about, you know, revenue models for AV Nation for years now. This is exactly what we should do. Just sign up for the Amazon, you know, Never mind. It was a bad joke, kids. All right. Moving on. From Innovate, Innovate on the Net. You know what? We're going to skip that. That was it was an augmented cable that let you cut off the power with a pinch. That was just kind of silly. So let's step into Mr. Schrogel's world. First of all, Josh, and I'm not you know kissing up or blowing smoke. But Josh has been writing about net neutrality for good God 14-18 months now. And that's not really a stretch. You can go on his website, soundreason.org, and type in net neutrality and see all of his stuff. So about a week ago, actually 1 week ago yesterday, Wednesday.
No, Thursday.
Was it Thursday? I thought it was Wednesday. Mm-hmm. All right. Thursday. The FCC finally came down. They voted, this, that, and the other. And they said, yay, we're going to do, you know, net neutrality, and we're going to make, you know, Internet Title II and this, that, and the other. Yeah, that's really great, and you can debate from a kind of a 50,000-foot view, freedom and all that jazz kind of focal point. But when it comes to AV and when it comes to the way that we kind of do things now, it kind of screwed us from a standpoint of, you know, there's a lot of networking that we do, and that, yes, there's a lot of intranet working that we do, right? Our own private networks, stuff that we put in or we control or we live on somebody else's. But it's the service contracts that you have that say that you're going to maintain your client's AV network, and the way you do that is by dialing in or you know tunneling into their network. Over the public network, or video conferencing, where what we're doing now, which is using Google Hangouts to connect four locations, we're using the public network. Josh, explain, because a lot of my views have come just from listening to you, and I don't agree with all of your views. So let's start there. But at least when it comes to the public network part, explain why this has kind of messed us over.
So. First, I'm going to stipulate the fact that the 317-page document that was voted on last week and approved at a 3-2 vote down party lines has not been released yet and is currently in the process of revisions. We don't know what those revisions are going to be. We don't know what will have changed. We just know that it will have changed. That's first and foremost. The second part of that is 2 weeks before they did that, or 3 weeks before they did that, they released a 4-page summary from Chairman Wheeler, which sort of spelled out what they were trying to do. And you can go online, you can go on my website. I've shared it. I've discussed it. I wrote about it for Commercial Integrator. And there's one stipulation in there that's really, really important to us, which is the fact that there's a statement, and it calls out specifically VOIP, voice over IP, as one of the identifiers of this, that any signal that exists on a private network but crosses over a public LAN is not susceptible to the Title II regulations, which means, and to go even deeper into that, it actually states that it cannot interfere with public signals on a public LAN. So that means that all of our point-to-point video conferencing, all of our VoIP, all of our business communications, any of our remote locations through VLANs or VPNs or any of that, that is an existing private network on a public LAN, will now be deprioritized under everything else that goes across that public network. That is literally what is stated in the 4-page summary. We don't know if that's going to change or modify or how that language is going to change until the 317-page document with revisions is released, but that is currently the summation of that section of this rules.
Okay. And when do you think that that's going to be released?
We're hoping for the next week or two at this point. It's been a week. They were saying 2 to 3 weeks to revise and resubmit, and we'll see what happens at this point. So we're already a week in, so I'm hoping for another week or two at most.
Okay. So here's the question, and this is kind of the roundtable part of this discussion. Based on that summary, Josh, And we'll start with you on this one. What can integrators, what can members of the community, what can manufacturers do to, I guess, protect what we already have, or going forward, make sure that, what we put in is still sustainable?
Well, it's understanding that utilizing a public, any terms of remote possibilities are what's where we're going to run into problems here. And this is where we have to start looking at what products we're specifying and whether or not they are going to be protected. We talk about one of the companies that has really emerged as a leader in the conferencing world has been BlueJeans in the last couple of years. And companies like BlueJeans or LifeSize or Pexip or Avaya, companies that are offering a cloud-based conferencing that isn't a point-to-point solution, are going to come out of this in a much stronger fashion than the others due to the fact that you're actually logging into a website or you're logging into a specific location on a public LAN, and it's not a point-to-point solution anymore. Now it's utilizing that bridge effect. So looking at those as solutions. So this is going to hurt companies like Cisco, like Polycom. And I mean, again, I mentioned LifeSize on both sides of this coin because they offer codec gear.
Yeah.
So that kind of solution is going to be big. It's a little bit more disconcerting when you think about remote login from for a rural client. So somebody that you, if you have to roll a truck 300 miles in the state of Texas, first is the first one that comes to mind because I've heard stories from there more than any place else about that one office way out there. And Texas is the major cities with a whole lot of desert in between. You're going to be seeing a lot more issues with potentially having to get out there. Now, as I say this, and I don't want to be a fearmonger in this, yes, we are not protected. That doesn't mean we won't be able to communicate with it. It just means that under the certain conditions where the bandwidth of the network is at max capacity or is running at a higher level, we will not be, we will be the first things to go if they need to find additional traffic. Say,
not go, but not be prioritized.
Yeah, we'll be the first thing knocked off the network, slowed down.
There you go.
We're not protected from throttling. I mean, that's one of the things that this build, that this rule does, is it protects you from throttling. We're not protected from that. So imagine that for a digital signage aspect where you're trying to stream content from one point to another across a public across a private network, but via public cabling.
There you go.
Now you're streaming to the digital signage is now going to be throttled or capable of being throttled. And the fact that it's not protected also means that the ISPs can do whatever they want. So if they want to start charging you because you're doing this, they have that capability. So now it goes from a point of not only are we not protected under the rules of Title II and have to be treated equally and fairly along with all other content on the network, now all of those ISPs that are providing us those connections can come and say, so you want to do your video conferencing? I hear you want to do that. Well, you know, I could break your knees or you could pay me $50. You know, it's that kind of a deal of they can, they do, they are being.
They are not the mafia.
They control the gateway for you to send signals.
I'm trying to protect you from being fear-mongering, and they're not the mafia.
I know. But again, it's the overreaching point and the caricature of the point that theoretically they could come to us because we are not treated as content providers as an AV service provider. They could go to those businesses and say, if you want your video conferencing to be treated fairly, you have to pay more. That because it is not protected under these rules.
Yes.
They have that capability. And that's where all of this turns into a massive, massive mess. And as you and I talked to many people at the BLC, and you heard me give the spiel over and over and over,
yep,
educating one after the next as to what was about to happen, you saw the jaws drop. You saw the people. I mean, again, I make the joke about the gentleman whose face turned white, called over his sales manager and said, repeat it. Why didn't anybody tell me this? And we go through that fact of I tried so hard for over a year to bring this to the AV community. And a lot of people listened. We got the listeners and the readers were wonderful and people have been responsive. Now, what can we do about it? we can band together and we can utilize groups like NSCA and Infocom. And I know NSCA was Rachel over there who works as part of the government advocacy group and government watchdog part of NSCA. She was adamant of what can we do? Where do we go from here? What's the next step? And my response is generally wait. There's nothing we can do because we don't actually know what the rules say yet. Yeah, we have an estimate, but we don't know. So this is where all this comes in, and they did bring this up at the NSCA BLC, and again, Infocom is another group that we can go to. Sending letters to – a lot of people are saying send a notice to your congressman, and I know Congress is trying to find ways to block this from happening at this point. They're still looking for ways to prevent this.
And let's be honest, they could. I mean, the FCC is not – they're not a monolith in and of themselves. They are – they're subject to Congress. The Congress could pass a law that says, you know, X, Y, and Z. So that's entirely possible.
Congress is trying, and Congress had two bills, one in each House, one in the House and one in the Senate, that was attempting to strip the FCC's ability to regulate this prior to the passing of this rule.
Yeah, and my only problem with that is that if they do that, then it strips the Title II, and you know,
it's a can of worms that just keeps getting bigger.
Yeah. All right, Dawn.
And that's my point is, and Josh, I mean, I defer to you as the expert. I got a lot of my education on this from reading Josh, from talking to Josh. I tell people all the time, go see Shrago. He's the expert on this. But my understanding is that in a way we kind of wanted this rule to pass because the alternative is they throttle everybody and they charge everybody that, you know, like the rule passing is a win for a free internet, so to speak, a rule for a less restricted internet, but at the same time, it still bones the AV industry.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like we're in a lose-lose situation, so which is the lesser evil for us to back until we can grab some lawmakers and educate them on what exactly they're doing? Because probably, Josh, if you got in front of them and educated them as to what they're doing, they would go white and their jaws would drop and say, oh, we're impacting big business in a major way, and a Comcast and whoever else, that they're not the only ones out there affected by this. We thought it was just them.
And it's funny you should say that. It's funny you should say that because of the fact that, as was announced on AV Nation this week, actually yesterday, I will be going to NAB to attend Chairman Wheeler's presentation this year. Also in that announcement was the fact that through partnerships and means, I was able to send three questions to be vetted by Chairman Wheeler's people. Whether or not they're selected and whether or not they are answered is an entirely different question. But over the course of the next 3 weeks, I will release each of those questions as to what I asked on behalf of the AV industry to try and inform them of what is going on. So we managed to get lucky and get the right people to listen and pay attention. And now it's just, can we keep getting lucky and get to that next step and get those questions actually asked before the rules are finalized? Again, we're in the revision process. If one of these questions triggers an issue, we could actually change the rules to protect us. It's whether or not we can get it there in time. And one of the questions I actually do ask, which I'll be releasing, does come into play of how all of that goes. So hopefully we can get those questions answered and whether or not we can get it in front of the right people, but we're trying.
Yeah. And just for clarification, we didn't get lucky. You worked your tail off. So to you. Mr. Reynolds, are you concerned about this at all? Is this something that's in your scope?
It may or may not be. And, you know, as Josh alluded to, there are a lot of things that we still don't quite know. You know, and Don makes a perfectly salient point that overall net neutrality is something we all wanted, because what we don't want is we don't want a tiered pay-to-play internet. And let's not misunderstand the difference between net neutrality and you pay more, you pay Comcast, for example, $40 for 20 meg internet, you pay him $60 for 50 meg internet. That's not the same thing as the pay to play that net neutrality is addressing whatsoever. They're completely different. And I think most of us understand that, but I wanted to throw that out to make sure that there wasn't any misunderstanding there. I don't know how much it will affect custom residential or custom commercial integrators like us, You know, we absolutely leverage VPNs to remotely connect to a client's location for troubleshooting, remote reboot, software updates, things of that nature. But they're usually pretty limited bandwidth and limited duration. So, and you know, your mileage may vary on how you as an integration company use that or not. We have a single office location, and then we do have secure VPN into the office from all of our homes. And we move some data back and forth there. I don't know if it's going to affect us or not. I'm hoping not, but I've been a big proponent of net neutrality as long as we don't have these ugly little caveats and loopholes that apparently there is potential for a gigantic one right here.
Yeah.
And I know that both of my senators from the state of Oregon have been pretty active in the net neutrality fight. And I don't know, it's probably worth continuing to submit information and opinions to both of them, as you know, Senator Ron Wyden has been very, very strong on net neutrality, and it might be worth continuing to try and contact his office and give our perspective as well.
Yeah, absolutely. One person I actually just thought of this, Josh, that I need to hook you up with, and that's Stu from IEG, who's a huge. If you're not familiar with IEG, it's a good network AV networking company. That we've seen at least the last, almost every show the last year or so. So it'll be interesting. So you're going to see Chairman Wheeler in about a month, at least sit in on the conference. NAB is the middle of April. So cool. All right. Here's the thing, guys. It's a deep subject. It's a subject that I'm with Bill. I have supported net neutrality from the basis of, not having a pay to play, not having us, we're AV Nation, we're a content provider, right? Had net neutrality not passed and not been protected, there was the possibility that we could be charged a monthly fee, a yearly fee from Comcast, from, Charter, which is my local provider here in St. Louis, from Time Warner, whoever, for providing you the content that we do. So from that aspect, and just from the free and open aspect, I've supported it. But yeah, let's make sure that we at least get our Congress people up and running and make sure that they're educated. So, oh, don't snicker at that. It's not my fault you have Feinstein. All right.
Moving on.
You know what, guys? That's going to do it for us. It's been a month since I've been in this studio, and so we've been back and forth from Amsterdam to Tampa with the BLC and this, that, and the other. So we're gonna wrap this up at 40. Bill, I appreciate it, sir. Our buddy George Tucker hooked me up with you, so thank you so much.
Absolutely, it's been a genuine pleasure.
Where can people find you or AV Awakenings?
www.avawakenings.com. We are located in Portland, Oregon. Primarily residential custom integrator. Do a little bit of light commercial when our arms are twisted behind our backs hard enough.
All right. Also with us is Miss Dawn Mead from AV. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Folks want to find me, I'm on Twitter at AVDawn. Very exciting. If you go to avnation.tv, check out the AV Social link. I'm one of the hosts of the AV Social podcast for marketing and social media. And our newest show just dropped, where we had the opportunity to speak with Peter Shankman, who is a marketing and PR genius. He's written 4 books. The whole point of this interview was we talked about his latest book, Zombie Loyalists, Using Great Service to Create, your loyal army. And, he's a genius, and I'm still fangirling about the fact that Kelly and I got to sit with him for most of half an hour, 45, however long it was, and talk with him about this book. So check it out. And my own company is NetAV, and give me about another week and we'll have our brand new website up. Yay. But it's net-av.com, NetAV here in Maryland.
Yeah, good job on getting Shankman, and you guys did a really good job. So, and Dawn's still blushing from talking to Shankman, so. all right, Mr. Shrago, thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Where can't people find you at this point?
You and I were talking about this earlier today. When I finally did the count, I think I have 8 live articles floating around the internet just this week. Somehow everything landed this week. It was just really amusing. But you can find me at the Twitter, at JSrego. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Commercial Integrator, Infocom All Voices, Infocom Certification Steering Committee. You can find me, oh God, AV Nation. I'm still technically the editor, I suppose. Yeah. And coming soon, you will find me in Las Vegas at NAB. Attempting to hunt down Chairman Wheeler and have a very, very brief conversation before Men in Black throw me in a car and hand me a shovel.
Know what? They won't do that. They typically, you know, dig the grave for you, don't they?
I don't know. I figured I'd stick with my mob mentality.
That's my. We pay good taxes for you to get your own grave dug. So. And Mr. Tucker, George Tucker, you know, the right side of my brain, sent me a note as we were congratulating our buddy Matt Scott on their he and his wife's first child, is to remind him the joys that are awaiting him, because George was supposed to be on this call and he got ill from his offspring. So you know, Matt, hey, that's something you have to look forward to. So. My name is Tim Albright. Don't follow me, because at this point I'm grousing about the Bears getting rid of Brandon Marshall. Go by the website, though. An awful lot of people do an awful lot of really hard work. At this point, I'm just the pretty face of AV Week. Josh does a ton of work. Don does. George, a ton of people do a really great job. So go by the website, avnation.tv. Avnation.tv, you will find this program and a host of others. Don mentioned the brand new AV Social with Mr. Shankman. We have a special up there that we did with Chuck Wilson at the NSCA last week. Next week, we're recording a new EdTech and a new State of Control. So yeah, all kinds of good stuff. And some new bloggers coming down the pipeline. Three new bloggers. Josh says three new bloggers, and he would be the person to know. So three new bloggers coming down the pipeline the next couple weeks. So check them out. Let them know what you think. Some really great folks in the industry. So thanks so much for watching. Thanks so much for listening. This has been AV Week.